You can use some of these dry bones samples.
Yes, that's nice.
Samples. Now that we've been talking for 45 minutes, Stephen, do you want to do an intro? I think it's the government trying to shut us down.
That makes sense.
Oh, God.
Well, this is your train wreck. I'm going to get a beer. Mm. I was just kidding. But I am going to get a beer. So I wasn't kidding.
Go get a beer.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
That's how you say it, Bettger.
That's how you say it. That's what I want to know.
Well, I say it Bettger most of the time these days. It was Suffering for a long time, but that's just a punk rock name.
I was just going to ask you, do you even go by that anymore, or is that your stage name still or anything like that?
Yeah, sometimes if I'm going to play any songs from the past or whatever, I usually just go by J Suffering. So sometimes I do solo shows, but not very often. I don't play out very much anymore. Not even like at church or anything. Sometimes, but not very much.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
Well, it's kind of the I'm better with a band, but organizing a band at this point in my life is so complicated, and it's just not very much fun. It takes sort of the joy out of making stuff. I'm having fun with the stuff I'm doing with Joe. Dry Bones, just
yeah, man.
He just sends me tracks and I just holler over them and screw around with recording stuff. I was doing it with my friend, but then I got enough balls to try to do it myself. So I'm learning Audition and using this field recorder and these other things that I have to screw around with.
Right on.
Getting it into the computer. Yeah. There was a fear factor I had to get over, though.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I remember. Do you know who Seth W. is?
Sounds familiar.
He was on Billy's show for an episode.
Okay.
He's kind of a tech geek. He's a good friend of both of ours. And he's really good at just, you know, knowing, like, the trends of the current way of internet and all that. He was telling me, like, back in, you know, 2001, you need to switch, you know, to the internet age. And it was like a threat. It felt like a threat to me. I can't really embrace the new way until everybody else is doing it.
I was the hardest thing for me was knowing the quality of recordings that I've done in the past with very talented individuals.
Yeah.
Knowing that I couldn't produce that on my own without a lot of trial and error. And then what I had to get over was the sort of quality factor in recording.
Yeah, totally.
And have it be more about the content of what I was making and enjoying myself doing it instead of comparing. And then it was really not a fear-oriented thing, but at first it was so...
Yeah.
It felt like, you know, you have this quality that you have to live up to in everything that you do, but it's just so expensive, and I'll eventually get there with technology and experience over time, so it's not that big of a deal.
Absolutely.
But it didn't... At first, I just had to sort of retrain my mind, and then, you know, I was creatively, like, stumped for years and years and years, and had some self-justifications around it, thinking I was doing better things instead of just being who I was and making my shit.
Yeah, and I guess some of that would be, I'm assuming, would be the Mars Hill stuff.
Yeah,
just some of that was definitely... busy with church and stuff like that.
Yeah, you get busy with that, and then I was a pastor there for a couple years, and always worked and, you know, I served there forever. So when I say work, I don't necessarily mean I was always paid to do work, but...
Sure. Yeah, I know that. I know what that means.
Yeah.
The word work is very expansive.
Yeah, totally. And there was a whole lot in identity things going on at Mars Hill, like particularly like gender roles and the way that we should function in a family and all sorts of things that my wife and I are just different than most of that. And so it felt like a part of me was sort of taken away in the name of God and religion, which I willfully did and chose. And now sort of post that, I think that a lot of that stuff were cultural issues that the Bible doesn't speak as clearly into, and done with good intentions, surely. Like, I don't even think that the ways of sort of reading into some of those things were with bad intent. The intent was often to follow and serve God appropriately, but that's kind of the point of Christ, is that there is no real appropriate way because we keep screwing it up, so we kind of need this incarnational being to do this ridiculous fairy tale type story, which I happen to believe is real, but it is a fairy tale in a sense because it's too good to be true. And I'm fine with it being that, and I'm fine with the mystery and the ambiguity and the strangeness of the stories and how they work out. But I don't think it's as clear gender roles is the way that Mark used to exegete them anymore.
Right.
It was easy to see when you're listening to him from his perspective and from the way that they talk about those things, especially, particularly because we're not talking about any other perspective at that time, so you didn't know that, like, you just made assumptions based off of what was said that, like, egalitarians and progressive Christians, which were called liberals or whatever, were just trying to, you know, like, justify their own sin or something, which isn't the case. The case in Christianity is everybody, like, has this mysterious, strange, bizarre encounter with Jesus, and suddenly you believe he's God, and you can't explain that because it doesn't make sense, and so you're trying to make sense of it.
Yes.
And the stories in the Bible make sense to a certain degree in a lot of ways around that, but his words are hard, and they're antithetical to anything we understand in our world because it's just the kingdom of God is different, that there ends up being all this mystery, and everybody seems that is a believer, you know, wrestles with that stuff, and so you end up with a huge plethora of multiple perspectives on how to live and what it could mean in an honorable way. And I think the main gist is that Jesus is God and is taking care of this, and it's potentially for all people, whatever that means. I have no idea.
I was going to say, what do you mean by potentially?
Well, it's pretty clear that the grace of God revealed in Christ is for everyone, but some people, you know, they get all...
I'm a Calvinist, just so you know, in case you need to know how to explain yourself to me. I just want you to know where I'm at with, so you know, like, you know, what terms will I'll understand and not understand and all that stuff.
Yeah, I tend to be more in the C.S. Lewis camp right now with a lot more ideas of universal atonement, which isn't universalism, which isn't that everybody's in heaven or everybody or whatever. It's more mysterious than that, I think. However, I resonate with a ton of things from Calvin and my things about my time at Mars Hill, like especially particularly perseverance of the saints. I really believe that Jesus saves and it has nothing to do with me. And so whoever he's saving is saved regardless of their sin or ability to comprehend. That's huge for me. But the election stuff I'm way more ambiguous about and don't even know. So I don't have many answers like I once did. And so what resonates with me lately is this idea more like in that book Prince Caspian that Lewis has. Mm-hmm. It essentially says there's this, you know, there's these tyrannical rulers that rule the kingdom, and then the prince comes back who's a benevolent, kind ruler, and he invites everyone to continue in the kingdom. He's just going to change it to be the way that it ought to be. And he even invites the tyrannical rulers to be a part of the kingdom. But they basically say, no, we don't want anything to do with you, and they exit and they leave, but the door's wide open. And that leaves a lot of mystery and ambiguity about when it comes to salvation. But I think that those are the types of ideas that Lewis seems to expound, even in The Great Divorce. And, you know, G.K. Chesterton had some ideas about that stuff, too. So there's that. I resonate with a lot more, like, mystical type things, not necessarily evangelical charismatic stuff as much, but so I don't
know. It's surreal talking to somebody from Mars Hill. If you knew, it's so weird because you guys were like in house, but you clearly know that it had an outreach that was way outside of Seattle, but from the receiving end in Pennsylvania, it was just such a different experience, and just such a shock when it all kind of imploded. And what's so bizarre to me is, you know, around I was de-churched for 12 years, and I just could not deal with the mediocrity and the I just could not understand. I knew that Jesus was real. I felt that discernment and all that, but like I just could not make sense of anything because I was raised in charismatic stuff. I was raised in like a weird small churches where it was there was nothing disciplined about it. It was very like biblically though. Like they weren't even teaching. Like I never even heard of election or any of the main themes of the gospel, even though I was raised in a Christian church for you know, at this point up to 18, 19 years. And then, I left for 12 years.
Speaking in tongues and being slain in the spirit was like commonplace when I was 4.
Exactly. So we're disconnected from church because to me it just seemed like either the system was broken or I was a broken Christian because, you know, the whole idea of like...
Well, both are true.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right on.
For everybody.
Well, I just mean in the sense that, like, like, okay, if what I'm being told is the way it is, then I'm not going to fit into it, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So like, you know, and then I did the Tantrum of the Muse stuff, was traveling around and stuff like that. I actually met you during one of the tours and played the Mars Hill Church there in Seattle, the club.
Yeah, you played at the Paradox.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And we all hung out after that. I don't know if you remember that, but
yep.
It was, yeah. So that was that whole phase, but we knew nothing about Mars Hill, but when Rick, our drummer Rick, joined the Huntingtons and kind of got away from the Tantrum thing, he went back to church and I kind of felt like he betrayed whatever thing we had going on. And the fast forward, he sent me a CD of the Nehemiah series that Driscoll was doing. And I just remember, like, I didn't know what to call it. I didn't know anything about theology. I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. But I just remember thinking, like, the dude's talking about stuff that's historically, like, there's, like, history involved in it. And there's, you know, I mean, like, a complete ignorant person would say, like, it sounds like he's preaching with, like, some sort of intelligence and, you know, and, like, there's stuff that is validating about this, because I've never been validated for anything I've ever thought, you know, and, like, you know, the long story short of it is, like, circa 2006 or 7 of Driscoll through maybe, like, around where he started doing Luke series, that was a pretty, like, intense time. I was really engaged in what he was preaching, and he had a huge, huge part in me going back to church, and I kind of split a little bit from some of the stuff he started to teach later, but you know, as I found my own place in church and were the things that I believed and all, but it's just so hard. It's so hard to imagine. I got this idea of Driscoll in my head that he was just like this dude who like had integrity, I guess, for lack of better words. Like he just seemed like the way he would speak to men like really resonated with me. And I know you're probably like you got this whole other side of it. So it's
yeah, there's a whole other side. It's complicated and
exactly.
I couldn't describe in any way, shape or form anything that would do the entirety justice. It's only my story.
Oh,
and
I know
that
I
take things out because it's so complicated, and obviously those people have affection for Jesus Christ as God, so they mm-hmm. love him, like all the people that were there that view things differently than me, because there's plenty. Like, there's plenty of people who view the way that I was candid about my experiences and about things that I would call abusive mm-hmm. Happening, that they would disagree 100% and actually turn it back around and say that I was you know, like a church destroyer or some crap like that. But that's just not mm-hmm. true in my opinion. I don't have
right.
much power. So and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. I can actually hear in when you're talking to Billy and stuff in the podcast I've heard you and Matt, like when I hear you guys talk about it, I can actually hear it in your voices that you're being incredibly like it seems to me like you're being like you had a lot of like let me put it this way. If I had been in your shoes, I would probably have like just lost my shit. I would have been like mad, like beyond angry, and I probably would have never been able to be as gracious as you two have been like in public about it. At least in the context I've heard. I know
it's a hot-headed Italian.
Yeah. I know that there's like thousands of things online and stuff, but like mm-hmm. I'm just saying like I feel like it sounds like you guys have been like really careful about not like giving yourselves over to the pain part of it. You know what I mean? Like, or maybe just from what I hear, you know what I mean?
It's there. And
absolutely,
it's less and less as time grows and I process it and I filter things more through a grace centered filter for even those folks, because I believe that it's my sin that I need to repent of. And I don't know that that will ever come to a head. It'll just be consistent all my life. Like there, mm-hmm. I'll do things with the best of intentions and with what I view as integral with the things that I want to be doing, and somebody's going to get hurt still. One of the biggest things for me that I've learned since then is gentleness is a real big fruit of the spirit that's very important. And I think that the sort of harsh authoritarian and I'm also an anarchist and now like fully aware of that in a way that I was politically while I was at Mars Hill. So I was there and considered myself an anarchist, and I've never voted a day in my life for various reasons about my anarchist convictions, but simultaneously I never applied it to ecclesiology, so which is the structure of how the church should be set up, but now I do. So now in that, my understanding of the way Paul speaks and appoints elders and stuff is much more of a community-oriented thing that's an acknowledgement of the people who had wisdom in their faith at the time that he was acknowledging and saying, yeah, listen to these people. They've practiced this. They're doing this thing, and they're obviously good models of how this should be done. So I think it's less of an authoritative thing and much more of an acknowledgement within the community of people that you should listen to when it comes to certain matters, which allows me to continue to... I mean, it's the same crap, like, right? Like, anarchy and Christianity is a weird thing in general, so I'm self-justified in my own right. It's the same stuff that I did as somebody at Mars Hill who was a pretty strong advocate for Calvinism and different systems and structures of church or whatever. I did the same thing, so I see it now that I see things differently. I also still know that I see things exactly the same from an American white guy who's privileged because I'm middle-class white dude. I can even have this position of anarchistic thought, whereas if I was not who I am, I probably couldn't be an anarchist because I probably couldn't even have that privilege to think the way that I do. It's so nuanced and complicated, all this stuff, that I really do believe more and more that the mystery of Christ's incarnation is so important as God modeled in Christ that he has empathy and compassion for those whom he created, and he understands our plight, and he understands the complicatedness of being human, and particularly, you know, what makes it more complicated is that we're Americans and we have houses and cars and stuff and can talk on the internet. If we just like lived off the grid and farmed and had a small community in our family, things would probably be a lot less complicated in our lives, and still we'd find these ways to like cause drama and hurt people and do shitty things. It's pretty sad. So no matter what, Jesus Christ is going to always be a strong fascination with me, because I feel like sort of towards the end at Mars Hill the last few years and then post, I've been growing in this thing that most charismatic Christians like just get, but it seems real to me, this idea of Christ as lover. It used to really bother me, and now it's this huge thing of like, there's this affection, and I don't need to intellectually understand everything because I have affection for him in a real sense that's akin to a lover and a friend, and that depth of intimacy and communion and those kinds of things are just so... They were foreign to me at one point, and my ideas were much more in my head and intellectual, but they've traveled in a way that... you know, I can cry a little easier now, and I can have empathy for some other people, and there's some things that in gentleness have just changed. I still like friggin' violence and horror films, which makes it hard to be... I'm kind of a pacifist when it comes to it in real life, but when it comes to aesthetics... I would prefer an action movie and gore over just drama or whatnot.
Right. Wow, no, I understand that.
I was just going to say, I'm glad you said that. I've never put a minute of thought into the phrase of Christ being, like even the Striper song, the first thing that popped in my head is Christ is the lover of your soul. And I never put a minute of thought into how that was phrased.
I love that you just found that lyric like
that's
in your
amazing.
Head. I know. No, it's
You want me to sing it? I'll do it.
I don't know it.
Don't. I was going to ask you, do you feel like your journey up to where you are now, or like I guess through the Mars Hill experience and all that, did that feel to you what's the word I'm looking for? You seem to be describing yourself as someone who had this sort of authoritative, like, you know, I don't know how to describe it, punk rock FU attitude or something, but are you trying to say that during that experience at the church and all that, was that, like, how you had to function, or, like, was the Christ as a lover part of it? Was that not there for you?
It wasn't. We made fun of, like, for instance, when this is the exact story how I knew things needed to change for me is who was a pastor got commissioned at the same time I did or ordained whatever at Mars was showing us this YouTube video of Kim Walker. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She is part of this church in Redding, California that's super charismatic. They're called like Bethel, and you know, a lot of conservative Christians really think that they're evil and all this weird stuff. They do sort of this attractional based ministry thing where there's like weird like gold dust shows up and stuff. I don't know what they're doing. It seems fabricated to me, but whatever. She's part of this band. I think they're called Jesus Culture, and she's got this YouTube video, and they're doing that cover of that. Well, everybody does it. That song by John Mark McMillan, "How He Loves Us," and. Hmm.
Uh-huh.
They're doing this song, and in the middle she starts ranting like, "Jesus, just come inside of me and grow bigger," and like all these things that are super sort of sexual.
Sorry.
And obviously they didn't meet, like she doesn't mean it that way.
Yeah.
And yet we're just making fun of it and going, "Oh my gosh," and we're thinking, I suddenly had this epiphany at that moment that we're making fun of this woman who is worshiping Jesus with her heart and soul, and she's saying these ridiculous things, and it sounds horrible to me, and I have no idea even how she has this much affection to even say that with a straight face and not think dirty like me. Mm-hmm. And so I actually asked God to forgive me and to show me at that time what it means to be his lover, and slowly he just started chipping away stuff like over and over again. And this affection started kindling in these ways that don't need to involve my intellect all the time. They do. My faith involves my intellect, but it also involves my heart in the same way that I love my wife, which is odd and was very difficult for, you know, like the Acts 29 Mars Hill camp, which I was never quite comfortable with all the, like, MMA fighter Jesus analogies and all that stuff, but but it made sense because seriously. I like violent movies and I like action and I like punk rock, which is aggressive and violent in nature, and I would perform in such a way that was so violent I'd hurt myself often, and there's all sorts of things like that have happened in my history that I could put up with that because there was a sense where I wasn't quite like tough guy like Cro-Mags, you know. Like I was always, when it came to punk rock, I would be much more akin to like the Dead Kennedys than I would be to like some of the New York hardcore stuff. So I mean, that says something too. I mean, but that's violent, right? But it's totally like guy with a lisp in San Francisco singing these intense political like. You know, the stuff that he's singing is storytelling and metaphor and hyperbole, and it's got some deep trains of thought. It's not just thuggish like a lot of the New York City stuff was. So, I usually resonated to punk on a more intellectual level. Same with Crass, whom I always loved. Crass, and they were so anti-Christ, but they didn't know Jesus. They were anti-Christ because they were anti-establishment and system that oppresses, and that's how they saw the church. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now. Yeah. I actually do see the church that way, like the American church, not Jesus Christ church, but the way that it's got a lust for power and for wealth and a lust for largeness, which I think Christ really calls us to be faithful locally with the people that we're in community with, which are our neighbors, mm-hmm. and where we do work, and where we, it's pretty immediate, and to build these platforms for yourself specifically just because you're a gifted rhetorical speaker, so that you can have more opportunities to speak rhetoric to more people is just a false gospel, in my opinion. I think it's an American way of doing stuff, saying that bigger is better when that's not true. God is the faithful right. one who saves.
All hiding behind the word outreach.
Yeah totally. And yeah. it's complicated because everybody enjoys, you know, doing something that is that's the rub too. Everyone enjoys doing something that seems relevant and meaningful and purposeful that other people are rallying behind. It's like a snowball. It just builds and builds yeah. and builds until suddenly there's just arrogance and self-righteousness, and you think you're a professional and know what you're doing when you're just another person. Like,
mm-hmm. mm, right
I,
on.
I mean, yeah. So,
yeah.
Christ's grace is still fine for those people. So I'm not saying that if you're involved in a mega church, there's a problem. I think that I don't want to practice that way, and I think it has its issues that I don't want anything to do with, and I do think are antithetical to the kingdom of God. And yet, Christ's grace is for me, who's a sinner, just like they are for the drug addict down the street and the mm-hmm. prostitute and mm-hmm. the Pharisee and the religious person. Therefore, it's equal. So there's no weird judgment. I'm just not interested in participating, and yeah. I have my reasons. And they do have to do with an ethic and a value system that I hold to.
I agree with you. Let me go back a few minutes here to that video you were talking about. Did you, when you had that sense of like you needed to ask for, to repent for your laughing at it and ask for forgiveness for that, did you feel like it was not okay? Like I don't know, there's a cynical part of me, and I don't think cynicism is very healthy, but I would say the cynicism in my life, I can't help but sometimes see the mediocrity, I guess, as I keep using that word, but it's kind of a good word to use. You know, when I see youth group videos with the, you know, the guy singing, you know, "You spin me right round, Jesus, yeah. right round," and the kids are swinging their socks in the air and stuff like that, you know, I'm just thinking like, ugh.
I sing this. You spin me right round, Jesus, right round, like a record, Jesus, right round, round, round. You spin me right round, Jesus, right round, like a record, Jesus, right round, sing it out.
Like, there's a part, like, do you feel like it's okay to laugh at it? Or do you feel like it's okay to find humor, even criticism, in critical humor like that, without necessarily feeling like you're condemning or judging those people? I'm just curious, because like cynicism is like a weird fine line, you know what I mean, like where you almost can be condemning.
Well, when you're... I think it's a compass. So if there's something that's bothering you, there's a reason why it's bothering you, and you should explore it with grace and mercy towards others. So they might not listen to you, which is probably the case. They usually don't listen to somebody who's more like a locust and honey eater, you know. Like that's how I seem to view myself. Even my personal blog's called locustandhoney.com. I haven't written much lately. I used to a lot towards before Mars Hill or during Mars Hill, and then at the end processing stuff, but there was some stuff that freaked me out, and I haven't been writing lately. I should again. Anyways, the point being that I think it's a compass, and I think that video just did something to me. And the way that I interacted, it was wrong for me to do, but it was done in such a way that showed me something new. And so it doesn't matter whether it was wrong or right. Christ used it as an opportunity to reveal himself in a deeper way to me. And so I don't think it's necessarily bad to point out that some of the things that she's saying sound uber sexual, because they do. But
or to find humor in it.
Yeah, I don't know that that's the problem as much as it was that I actually, in some reasons, was self-righteous in thinking that we were doing things better. Before that, like the Mars Hill whole thing was originally when we started playing music there, it was, you know, like worship the Lord with a new song. Let's sing a new song to the Lord, like out of Psalms. So the idea was we were writing our own music in the way that we wrote them. So there was a lot of contextualization. That's how I got there, was the fact that I liked punk rock, goth, industrial, noise, like obscure, mm-hmm. bizarre music. Punk probably at the time, you know, in the mid, late 90s was popular because there's Green Day and Rancid and all that. But I had grown up listening to all of that kind of not just, I mean, I listened to alternative music too, or college rock, what it was called in the late 80s, early 90s, which is called indie rock now or whatever, but it's
yeah,
it's the I listen to all of that stuff, but the things I gravitated to the most would be, you know, like I said, Dead Kennedys, Minor Threat, Black Flag, Subhumans UK, yeah. Some of my favorite punk bands. Well, simultaneously, I really liked some of the crossover stuff like DRI and Corrosion of Conformity, and
yeah,
there was The Accused from the Northwest here in Seattle. I love that band, and they were total like metal punk hardcore crossover. And then I was way into goth too. I loved Bauhaus and The Cure, and I loved Einstürzende Neubauten and Skinny Puppy. Like, I liked just bizarre dark music, and I enjoyed horror movies and psychological thrillers, and going to Mars Hill the first time and being accepted and them understanding and not trying to trying to change me or say that what I was into was wrong, but understanding that I could be a Christian and like these things and wasn't put into question. That was how I started going there in the first place, and what resonated with me the entire time I was there was that I had this solidarity with these people of faith, and we might not agree on everything, but it was never questioned that I was a believer and follower of Jesus because of the things I listened to or enjoyed, which when I'd go on tour in 90 Pound Wuss, and even growing up in my hometown, which is about 2 hours west of Seattle in a small town called Port Angeles, I never fit in with Christians. It was only the punks, but I couldn't quite fit in with them because I was a Christian, but I still did. They were the most gracious more than the Christian. So there was this complexity to that relationship. And so it's pretty easy when you have, like, I'm very loyal to people, and I do things for a long time in one direction, and I'm very gracious with people's motive and intent and not that terribly suspicious of people. Which has gotten me into trouble sometimes, but it's also nice when it doesn't. And so in that sense, I could stay at Mars for a long, long time, even though it was, you know, the first smell of garbage to me was about 2002. And then at least every 2 years, if not every year, there'd be another thing that I'd be like, I don't know about that. That's weird. But you just kind of overlook it because, for one, you see what's happening. For two, it seems very American and very like, oh, God's blessing it because it's growing in numbers, which his blessing is Jesus Christ. It has nothing to do with your provision. That's just great that he provides for you.
Yeah, totally.
And he gives you Christ. But it's not some numbers thing. But I was, you know, it's easy to be tricked, just like a band, right? Like, you can get your sense of worth. If your band is the band that's friggin' popular and everybody's loving it, you're gonna feel like you're doing something real special and you're really good, when that doesn't mean anything. Like, you might be a crummy musician. You might not even write good songs. It just might happen to be the flavor of the day. So it's so subject to who you know, who has money, who's putting their time and energy. That's all that numbers are. Like, I don't know that there's any reason to do anything just to be popular. I think a lot of people do it for those reasons, and I think that they're stupid now, and I'm not interested in doing that. I may do something that's marketed and may do something that has broader appeal, but that won't be my motivating factor. That just might be there because I'm working with some other people who are wired that way to work that way, but I'll always be the one advocating for authenticity, for candor, and for vulnerability on any team I'm part of.
Too long. No longer will I refrain from questioning you.
I can't imagine there's anything left, but is there anything about the subject that you feel that you still need to say? About the whole the big Mars Hill thing and all that stuff.
Yeah, that to me, I don't know what I have to say about that anymore. I mean, it's been a little while now, and
that's what I mean. We're kind of late to the game with the whole like breaking news end of it. But
oh yeah, it's still interesting, and there would be different elements and reasons, like Stephen was describing earlier, you know, about his take on it. I'm sure it's probably pretty surprising when suddenly you have some people who were there and it had an influence on your life, and then suddenly these people that you also respect in music circles and other things do this, you know, just exit, and I'm sure I can imagine there's yeah, tons of weirdness. So the it was really confusing. I can say that being a part of a cult is really confusing.
You consider Mars Hill Church a cult?
I consider the cult of personality very dominant and evident, and there was cult-like tendencies there. And for me, I would probably say yes, I was part of a cult.
Let me ask you something.
Everybody would say that, and I'm not being very generous with it when I say that.
No, I sympathize with your side of it for sure. I mean, what do I know, man? I'm downloading it on iTunes. that's the extent I had. But right, let me ask you this though. Are you able to see, despite the tremendous amount of what you lived through, experienced, are you able to look outside of that and see how Mars Hill Church was used internationally? Certainly, and just from downloads all the way over here in Pennsylvania, are you able to see that and say, okay, God did do something really huge and it worked, despite maybe the back behind the scenes stuff was all, you know, broken and all that. Like, what do you think? Because I mean, I value what I've learned from the things I've heard, you know, and it helped me, and I don't want to go on record and say that wasn't, you know, something that God used. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't, from a disconnected, you know, downloading the iTunes and stuff, that's how it was for me. Are you able to see it from your side?
I can say that it was used for like anything else is used. Everything has its positive and negative,
mm-hmm,
and everything has good and bad things happening alongside each other, things that are helpful and things that aren't helpful. I think post, I have a different reflection, and I could see that in some ways it really inspired a lot of people towards thinking about Jesus Christ in some ways that are more helpful, and other people to think about Jesus Christ in some ways that aren't helpful one bit, and they got the gospel really confused with conservative politics or certain other agendas, and that yeah, bothers me, because they're not one and the same, in my opinion. Some people think differently, but life and humanity are complicated. That
yeah,
it's a hard question to answer, because sure, yeah, totally, great. But you know, at the same time, the things that I resonate with that matter to me are not large scale rhetoric being spoken to a bunch of people. Like, that's not actually the thing that's transformative. That's just you hearing something from a different perspective and thinking about it. So I think the real change and the real different things and the real beauty happens amongst other people and in other people. And I'm not one for podcast pastors, although I do listen to the Mockingbird Society's Mocking Pulpit sometimes, and that's fun. But I like talking with people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that a lecture is the best view. I think it gets people sort of thinking that that's what church is and that's how you have to hear the message of Jesus Christ is through a preacher. And I just don't think that that's true. It wasn't for a long, 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 long time, as for hundreds of years at least, as it was passed down orally before the first written record of the New Testament mm-hmm. exists. You know, people were... So, I don't know. It's certainly what you're saying is true. Obviously, an organization that has influence is going to have positive influence for some and negative for others. Sure. I just think the metrics that we use to measure sort of this grace of God thing is bullshit. Like, the grace of God is Jesus Christ, and anything else is just a thing. And somebody else might experience the elements of Christ through whatever's happening in the culture or even in Christian culture, but it doesn't mean that it's... Is it a good or bad thing is what it comes down to, and I believe it was both. And that's...
No, I mean, absolutely, from your side of it especially, you can't disconnect them. I guess it's interesting, because the one other thing I would point out from my side of it is, like, I Mark Driscoll wasn't church for me. You know, he was someone I'd listen to at work on a podcast episode, you know, or an iPod, you know. So that's another thing I think that kind of helps disconnect the differences, is like I he was like one of several people I just put in my ear throughout the week, you know what I mean? So it was I wasn't in a church setting being preached at by him. He was an hour of Christian audio. You know what I mean?
Same.
So for that, I think that kind of helped too, being on the outside, kind of just hearing it for what it was in my ears. You know what I mean? And yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, man. It's just, it's such a strange thing. It's like, you know, if you're disconnected from it and you're just hearing it, you're just hearing the audio, you're just kind of like, you're taking it in, and I felt so connected. It's so weird. I don't know how to... I almost moved to Seattle to be a part of that church. It's
probably because
I didn't know. What's that?
It's probably because he's blunt. I mean, that was really attractive. Nobody was just telling you what they thought. And in some ways, most preachers are very gentle with their words and sometimes elusive. And oftentimes esoteric. And he was just blunt. And then he'd tell you what to do, which was like, what does that mean? Well, you should live your life in X, Y, and Z, which to me is the problem with the way that he did it. But that's one of the reasons I also think always a lot of people... Hopefully not now, it seems like, I shouldn't say, I'm an anarchist, politics don't matter, but a lot of people resonate with Trump that are conservative, probably because he's freaking blunt, and he tells it like it is, and he's like, people are sick of sort of diplomacy and political rhetoric, and they just want to be told what it was. So there was something attractive with Driscoll in a place where people are much more so I think it was attractive.
No, I get what you're saying. He was definitely,
but I don't,
it was definitely something that was a little more, I think it was a little more effective for people like me who just really were close to any sort of familiarity of what pastors seem to be like, and I think it worked in that respect. But I definitely...
Well, it was attractive to me, too. I mean, one of the points when I knew he was, like, I wanted to be there and stick around and knew him was Matt was living in his basement, and we got back from a tour or a show or something, and I dropped Matt off, and Mark was mowing the lawn, and he said, I fucking hate mowing the lawn. And I was like, that's my pastor. I'm here. Like, that guy just said, I fucking hate mowing the lawn. And I was like, that's my pastor. I'm here.
You just
needed to be
real. Just be yourself.
He needed to be a sailor with his mouth.
Yeah.
And then I knew, okay, he's a real guy. He's legit. But that was a stupid, immature thing for me. There was some... Well, at the same time, you know, like, he was also... It's not like he was a jerk. I mean, not all the time. He'd get pissed off and be real angry, and I've seen him get red in the face and treat people like shit, but at the same time, I also saw him be really kind-hearted and loving people, and it's just like everybody. So Mars Hill, I think where it got off base and terrible was where everything was a means to an end, and that that shows, like, that shows in the most predominant and public way was the Result Source campaign, where they hired a marketing firm to make sure that the book Real Marriage would be on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, that's a lie. That's like record labels manipulating SoundScan numbers so that a band can get on a better tour and make more money.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lie. It's not the truth, and it's doing it in the. It's even worse than the band stuff because it's doing it in the name of God, thinking that platform's better than what you're giving. So it's covetous. It's lying. It's cheating. Mm-hmm. Deceptive. It's everything that's antithetical about living the way of Jesus Christ. And, you know, since that came out, he even said that he realizes that it was a bad decision and a wrong choice. Well, yeah, but which is fine. Like, he can repent. That's great. But what I'm telling you is that type of thinking is the problem. It's makes unethical decisions because it says the more people that are listening and the more people that do this validates me and what I'm doing more and builds my kingdom in such a way that I get more validation and I feel better about myself,
right.
And there's more money and there's more things and it's big. It's just crap. It's totally not the ways of Jesus. It's not the ways of the kingdom. So suddenly Mars Hill was preaching what I would adamantly say is a false gospel, because you can't live and be the preacher in such a way that is completely antithetical to the gospel. You're just a hypocrite. So you're once again, and everybody's a hypocrite, but you're when you're self-justifying it instead of repenting of it, which he did later, according to his words, publicly repented from that particular thing of the Result Source campaign and using it. That's good. I'm glad he did. But it's hard to gauge even what that means, because I also know that their whole thing was to spin everything to self-justify and make themselves look better and the other people to look worse. They did that internally, which was abusive, because you do that to employees or people that quit, and they'd suddenly be cast out of community just because they had a differing opinion. It was like, no, they're a toxic person who doesn't respect their authority and all this stuff. So it was essentially authoritative heavy-handedness being used to manipulate and control in such a way that was toxic and very hurtful and harmful to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And most of us didn't see it because there was enough lies and enough weird things going on behind the scenes to self-justify. But that was the gospel that was being lived out. So therefore, it almost... And I can tell you personally that as I started seeing more clearly, most of the things that were said from the pulpit at some point were very obvious attacks against specific people that were either had quit the church or had... he was in conflict with at the time or didn't like something about. So it was very, very manipulative and controlling. But you don't see that unless you get to see how the sausage is made. Otherwise, it just looks like a
thing. That's not something, right? You're not going to see that downloading in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, totally.
You mentioned that you were going to do a podcast with Matt Johnson. And I'm curious, because you told me the name of this show. And so I wonder how that ties into what we're talking about here, or if it does at all.
What exactly
is the plan there?
Matt and I are working on some ideas around themes of being involved in religious institutions, and we want to talk about that. But it's mainly like that'll be the first and sort of the theme that we'll be talking about at the beginning, and then it's pretty much just a thing for me and Matt to do whatever we want. But we're going to call it Surviving the Megachurch, mostly because we survived the megachurch. I mean, we're still in touch with our faith in some deep ways that are profound and different than they once were, and they model and are, I mean, we're totally different. He's much more liturgically oriented and really likes the Lutherans a lot right now. I don't mind that stuff. I actually like it too, but we're different in some of the ways that we've landed, but yet we have a huge history of being together. We have deep conversations and enjoy them. So we just figured, you know what, why don't we bring some other people into this? And for me, writing is not my forte. He's a really good writer. Hopefully yeah. he'll have some books out and some other stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I know he's writing one. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, me too. So this was sort of our way to process some of this stuff as well as to continue being in relationship with each other. We'll probably do something like once a month. Maybe it'll be once a week. I don't know. But I'm trying to change my whole lifestyle to be around monthly rhythms instead of weekly rhythms lately because I just feel too overwhelmed. I'm like...
Yeah, man. I respect that a lot. I feel the same way.
It seems impossible,
like this, we have
though.
This weekly podcast.
Yeah, totally.
Travis. If it was up to me, this and to the...
And it's not.
Probably to the... Yeah, exactly. To the fall of the show, I say that with as a respect to Travis. The show would have been biweekly, and I still probably wouldn't have been on every episode. And yeah, it just we've been growing the show, and Travis has been plugging away weekly. But it's been hard to keep up to a weekly schedule with everything.
I'm concerned about outreach. Yeah, if I'm trying to get it out there. I'm trying to, you know, if people can't make it to church early on Sunday morning because they have soccer practice, I'll have Sunday afternoon service. And then if football interferes with it, I'll do one on Wednesday morning. I do what I got to do, you know?
Yeah totally.
Yeah.
All in the name of God.
Podcasting.
All in the name of God and stuff.
It makes sense to do a show on a regular basis, and if you can pull it off, that's great. I just...
Yes.
Yeah.
It does, and we can, and Steven's a big crybaby.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we might make it scalable where we could do it every week. We plan to record a bunch before we launch, but that's mostly because we're working with another friend of mine, Zach, who has the Losing Our Religion podcast, and he started it. It's called Counterculture Society, and it's sort of a network to help out people of like-minded things. So we'll see how that goes. But he's more geared in that mindset of being able to do something and have strategy towards it, where I just want to do it. Like, I feel good if I get something. Like, I have ready to go. There's this other thing I'm doing called These Artists, which my idea behind it is to interview different creative folks that I admire or like or want to, and then instead of talking about what they do or how they do it, I want to talk about why they do it and who they are. So there's like this, it's really hard to get some of those answers. It's really difficult. But there's an esoteric kind of quality to it, which some people don't like and some do. And so I'm ready to put out a couple of those, and I just want to do it on my own personal SoundCloud and stuff. But he's like, hold on, man. Like, there's people that would be interested in hearing these things that you have. Let's tap into that. And I'm willing to listen. It's not church. It's something I'm doing, so that's a whole different thing. I think when it comes to being God's people, I really resonate with the gathering of those people being done in an authentic way to them that involves remembering the narrative. I don't think exegetical preaching is the only way to do that, and I by far don't think it's the most effective. That's more of a lecture, in my opinion, than an actual communion with God and his people. So I go and I'm staff at a church that practices an exegetical sermon every week, but I'd be the one who would push back on that the most. So I don't mind it that much. I'm fine with hearing people have a one-sided conversation about what they think and believe. Scripture saying, that's fine, but I'm not that interested in it. So either way, a gathering involves remembering and some sacraments. Like if it's happening and you're taking bread, whether it's every week or whatever, and there's baptisms happening and you're gathering regularly, like that can be church. I don't care if it's at your house. I don't care. Whatever. Like, I'm really open to those approaches not being regimented in such a way that has a brand associated and identity around it. I just think it's God's people, and I'm much more interested in that. But when it comes to actually business stuff, I'm so unwired to exploit myself and unwired to be capitalist about it that it, I oftentimes do need some help with some people that are, well, you live here in this country and you have some bills to pay and some other things, so why don't you think about it in these perspectives? And I'm willing to work with those people to do what they need. I mean, that's why,
right,
like, being on Tooth and Nail was good for 90-pound Wuss at first, was because we would have never thought of, well, for one, obviously we wouldn't have had any opportunity anywhere else, but for two, I wouldn't have thought of any of the stuff that you have to know about the music industry to be a musician and record music and put it out there and have people purchase it. No, I'm just not.
I know.
Not,
yeah, good. I know what you mean. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of that, speaking of music, you know, I feel weird. It's like, on one hand, it's like I want to talk a little bit about your music and stuff, but I feel like, you know, everybody knows all about your music, but in particular, I do want to get into some of the stuff you're doing with Joe. I'm kind of curious about that because I've known Joe for a while. I met him in 2000 at Tom Fest, and we've been email pen pals ever since. And I just think he's such an awesome guy. I love him to death, and wish we could hang out more or ever. We never get to see each other, but yeah. I was a little surprised when he announced he was doing this project with you. I was kind of excited about it, and I heard you guys were going to put a record out, and he was sending me some stuff you guys were doing, and I love it and dig it, and it's just totally, it just reminds me of, like, I don't know, like something like, I don't want to, my go-to stuff with some of the music you've done has been like stuff like Michael Giro would do, or like Angels of Light, and then not Dry Bones. You're the Suffering and Hideous Thieves kind of reminded me of that stuff a little bit. But this stuff's like real oppressive sounding, kind of like creepy. The Dry Bones, and
yeah,
I'm just I too am into a lot of like weird avant-garde stuff, and so it definitely resonated with me. What exactly is going on? Is that record still coming out? Is this a band?
Yeah, it's Joe and me. I was working with my friend Jared for a while, recording vocals, because he was really talented, and then he's got some stuff going on and has been busy, and he lives about 45 minutes from here. It's kind of a pain. It takes longer than that every time I go up there. So I just started screwing around with trying to record stuff on my own. So Joe just sends me tracks. It was just this idea we had as we talked back and forth about some stuff. I met with him. I've known him for years as well, on and off. He interviewed me for a zine, and I do support-based missionary work. I'm essentially an urban missionary in the city of Seattle, so I work with a organization called Redemption Group Networks. I work with Artist Reformation, which is my faith-based arts nonprofit that we started. I started here, and it's so I do that, and then I raise support through an organization called Reliant Missions that's in Florida, and I'm essentially like an employee. So I basically have this amount of money that I'm supposed to raise, and then they sort of pay me out of that and take care of taxes and take care of all my 401k and all that stuff, so I don't have to worry about it. But it's kind of like Campus Crusade or some stuff like that. But what else do I do? I also, you know, I get to be work as volunteer staff at, well, for originally Mars Hill, and then we started our own little church gathering here in my neighborhood for a while that met at a small brewery here, but it didn't seem like it was the right time, so I went back to a church called A Seattle Church that a bunch of my friends go to, and some friends started, and I basically started helping out there, and so we're there. But through that all, since I've raised some, what's that? Yeah, that's where we're at currently.
Okay.
Yep, my housemate, we have people that live with my wife and my family and I, and our housemate Katie does the worship there. She's a talented, great musician. So anyway, and my friend Tim Gatos, who I served with at Mars Hill Downtown for a long time, he was sort of the lead pastor at that church.
Okay.
He's there. So anyways, since I raised support, I reconnected with Joe, was asking if he'd be interested in supporting us, and you know, he's helped me out with some web stuff and some other things, and then we just started communicating more and more. We decided to try this project, so he sent me some tracks, and eventually I started laying down some vocals, and we really liked how it was going, and I really liked sort of these rules that I made for myself with it, which is all about scalability. It's all about my lifestyle, so they're not well thought out. The songs are literally me going in, the time that I have allotted to record and work on them, writing the lyrics at that time, editing and coming up with the melodies or the bass lines or anything, all in that time frame of 2 to 6 hours, whatever I'm working on, and that's it. So if I say Friday I'm going to work on Dry Bones stuff, I mark it on my calendar, and that's the time I work on it. I might, like, when he sends me a track, I might listen to it once, and then I file it away and wait for that day and pull it up, and then there I go. I might have some ideas that I jot down here and there for song ideas that I come back to or revisit, but generally speaking, I don't spend a lot of time beforehand. So it's a gracious rule. I'm not bound to it, but that's what made it able to happen, was for me to say, I want to make music. I don't want to take the time to go over a song and edit it and all this stuff. So I'll just, the other rule is that I use whatever Joe sends me. If he sends me 30 seconds, I'm not going to add to it more past 30 seconds. I'll add anything within the context of that he sends me, and that's it.
A gang of wolves led by lions! That is your violence! Indulge me with injustice! Hidden greed! I will rip out your tongue in order to cease your lies! I will restore the ones you oppressed! You fraudulent beast, I will make you see, I will force you to see! I will be your sacrifice, then feed you my own flesh and blood! Then you will know, then you will know! I am and always have been, everything is mine!
So Dry Bones is pretty improv. It's an improv thing for the most part for you.
Well, you know, I'm recording it, so I make edits to my recording if I want to. But for the most part, it's not really rehearsed. So it's not completely improv. I'll write my lyrics, and I'll think about it during that allotted time as they come up.
Sort of a spontaneous forcing yourself to come up with something right on the spot.
Yeah, if you're in a band and you have an objective, we're going to write one song tonight. That's it. Like if you came up with your band, we're going to write one song and we're going to finish it and not be done until we're going to do this right now, and you have nothing and from scratch, it would be that. So if you're writing lyrics in that context, and the music in that context, that would be more how it is. So but with 90 Pound Wuss, you know, and Raft, we would rehearse, and we'd get to a certain point, and when we were stumped or whatever, we'd stop. And with Hideous Thieves, it was more like I'd come with something fleshed out that I'd been working on my acoustic guitar or my electric or whatever, and then I'd present it to the band. And if I had a specific part for a thing that I wanted somebody to play, I would dictate it to them, and then they'd add their own things to it. And so that one was more like that. Yeah. I'd be working on songs for months beforehand.
And that's obviously a completely different kind of package than Dry Bones too. I mean, that's like a lot. You had a lot more musicians and stuff to work with.
Yeah.
For that project.
At least it's just scalable to where I'm at now in my life.
Yeah, exactly. That's cool. Is Dry Bones planning to release anything, or are you just putting singles out?
So what we're gonna do? We decided that we don't want to do. This was the hard part. Like, what do we want to do with this thing? And it was Joe's always wanted to do a full length. But I don't really give a crap about that. Nobody's, like, it's hard to sell anything these days. It's hard to, like...
Oh, I know.
Yeah. I know, you know. Like, you put a lot of work into that record, man. And it sounds great.
Thank you.
The bits I've heard. So, I haven't heard the whole thing yet. I should. But, the,
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Matt's heard the whole thing. I'm pretty sure he does. He said he really liked it and dug it. I've just heard bits and pieces from the other stuff. But anyway, we
Yeah, that's cool.
With Joe and me, we were just hung up with, and then we heard basically Bandcamp came out with the subscription based thing, and we decided to do that. So we're gonna do yearly subscriptions and put out at the minimum one song every month. And so the only people that can ever hear our music and download it are people that want to support us as artists. So if somebody gives us 25 bucks a year, they will get a minimum of 12 songs that year. And if there's a bunch of people that end up doing it, we'll probably create a lot more content. We're going to try to release videos that we'll put on YouTube of stuff, like arty things that'll have our songs so people can still hear it. But if you actually want to own it, you'll have to subscribe to that. And there's a SoundCloud page that has a few songs. We'll probably put those ones up for free on our Bandcamp, those songs that are already on SoundCloud. But other than that, it's going to be we just decided to do subscription-based. We're kind of advertising it. We did a little bit on Facebook or whatever, but it's one of those things that we're just going to do. And eventually, like, some people might want I don't really think it's a little more than buying a record. Right? 25 bucks a year, and you're probably only going to get 12 songs, maybe more. So it's a little bit more, but I think because of that, it also has... I still think it's reasonable. Like, every month you'll have something to listen to. Yeah. And I like the model and the ideas behind it. So, essentially, you know, it's like you're basically... Yeah. It's a cross between artist patronage and... buying an album somewhere in between that. We have another one that's $50 a year, and you get a T-shirt, and probably we'll probably make stickers or something at some point and send them to everybody who's a subscriber, and thank you cards and other things like that. But for the moment, that's what we decided is going to be our model. So that's yes and no, we won't really have a full length. It'll be one song at a time. We might at the end, Joe really does want to press something. So if we have enough supporters, we'll probably make, like, if there's enough money in a bank account from people who decided that they want to hear our music, we'll probably press something and either give it away because they helped finance it, if we can, or sell it and those people get it for less and maybe other people get it for more. I don't know.
I love that idea because I think that there's definite value in creating an entire album the old way where you actually have, like, a... Not a concept album, but like a cohesive, like, this is a group, this is a cluster of 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 songs, whatever, however long you are.
Mm-hmm.
But there are no more rules, and you can do stuff like this, and I would like to see, you just spent a long time setting up your situation, and you know, I'm dedicating this evening to finishing a song, or he sent me this blurb, and I'm going to work on this. Like, that's clearly not the old days of we get together in a room and woodshed for 5 hours three times a week. We can't do that anymore. So the format is just allowed to be different now, and if we have this interweb thing where we could just push a button and put it out there, I love the fact that people are thinking outside the box and doing this kind of stuff. I tip my hat to you. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Definitely. Thanks, man.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. We'll see what it holds. So far, there hasn't been a lot of traction. A lot of people say that they really like it, but there's only been a few people who are interested enough to subscribe. But we only have one song up there right now that you can download. So I think that after we do it for a year and there's 12 songs, that makes more sense, particularly when there's a back catalog of 30 songs and plus you get the whole new year's worth and you can download the back catalog. That will probably have a lot more people interested because you feel like instantly you have value. Right now, people are paying it forward, and they have no idea if we'll produce the content or not. But in the future, when the content's there, and you subscribe for 25 bucks a month, and you get 100 songs or something ridiculous, plus
that's cool.
all these new, then that's a then there's more value.
You're starting building right now, one brick at a time. I like that.
It'll be interesting to see how that pans out, because I've not heard of that model myself, and you know, there's Kickstarter and there's those things like that, and I'm assuming that there it goes. I was gonna say, I'm assuming that you're avoiding the quick route of let's see if people will fund this and then we'll just give it to them.
Well, but we thought about doing that, and there's inherent problems with that model. One is the amount of time that you actually have to invest in social media to get it out there to make sure that people hit those marks so that you can do what you want to do. I wasn't interested in that, so there was some things like Indiegogo and some other places that made some sense, maybe, but then at the same time, it was like, we're going to just do this thing, and I don't want to... I have so much else that I'm doing that I don't want to focus on marketing my project. Yeah. I do that with Artist Reformation, with projects we work on, and that's already hard enough and proven way difficult. Why would I do it for a personal one when I want to do this? So what's a way that we can do it and just do it? And there was originally, I mean, we had that SoundCloud page because originally we were like, we should just give them away for free. It's just time. And then in the end we were like, well, you know what? I don't really want to. I don't really want to like be on Spotify or streaming services. I care enough about my art to put the time and energy into it, even though, like I'm saying, I have this time to work on it. So, but that's part of this particular project's ethos, and the coolness of it is that you get like raw Jeff. Like the thing that I do is the thing that I do, and people either like it or they really don't like it at all. But I have this one-dimensional sort of way that I sing and make music. And so to get it without it being overly processed and raw is interesting in and of itself. So I think that this project, it's not lacking just because I make it scalable. It's actually adding to it because I'm doing that purposefully so that I can produce content. And we're not going to put out a bunch of crap that we hate. Like it's flexible enough that I can still redo everything if we think it sucks. So it's not like, it's not just experimental, but it adds the elements of experimental, improvisational, as well as being well thought out. Because I have come back, like there's a couple tracks that I came back the next time I had scheduled and said, let's redo this. Like I want to change some stuff here and there, and I don't like this, or I like this, or I want to add a bass part or a guitar or whatever. So I still have done that, but for the most part, it's still within the context of when I have scheduled to work on it. So all that being said, I think that this model has something interesting to it, particularly if it comes to us producing stuff within that month and releasing it. At some point, we're not going to have a back catalog for me to draw from. At some point, it's going to be, okay, this is I'm really doing this. I'm going to make this. And so it's good for me creatively. It puts me in a position where I have responsibility around my aesthetic and creativity for people who are supporting us, whether there's 2 or 500, it doesn't matter. But and then the content itself and engaging with that, I really like the concept, how it's going to play out in my life and in reality. I mean, it could just be a dumb idea, but it doesn't matter. It sounds fun right now, so I'm going to keep doing it.
I fully think you should pursue it, and for the reasons that it's fun.
Yeah, totally.
If it becomes a dumb idea, I don't think it's a dumb idea. I think some great ideas just don't sometimes get the legs that they need. But we'll see how that goes. I'm curious about that, and I'm very excited to hear more. You know, the music too. So,
well, it's Bandcamp, and then whatever they do, our band name's Dry Bones, DryBNZ. So, however Bandcamp's set up, that's where it's at.
I'm still trying to remember that spelling. He switched it on me. I remember it was like normal, like in the very beginning.
Yeah,
it got switched on.
It's just DryBNZ. We like that better. We think.
Yeah, I think it's cooler. Yeah,
about what absolutely. We're doing. It's a little witch housey.
Witch house. I don't know what witch housey is.
It's some dumbass made-up name for a genre of music that probably doesn't exist. No, it exists.
It exists now.
Well, it exists. If you see all those bands that have like their names spelled like ours, and they do some weird hybrid of electronic kind of gothy music, that's sort of what it is. Which
I saw a band recently called Cross with three S's, and it was kind of like that kind of music. So,
is that Chino?
No.
That's just a bunch of cross. It's kind of like Prince with the symbol.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this band's called Cross, three S's, and it's just like it's spelled out CROSS.
Have you heard Knives?
I want to say yes.
Clips of it on podcasts and stuff.
It's Ryan Clark.
Oh yes, I've heard it on his episode with Mark.
We're just on a comp for Bad Christian with Knives. It was funny. It's Dry Bones, and the Knives is right after or before us.
Wow. Well, you know, it kind of reminded me of Depeche Mode a little bit, his stuff.
Yes, Knives. It does. He's always been into Depeche Mode ever since I can remember.
Yeah. I mean, I love Depeche Mode. I'm just not a Demon Hunter fan. I'm a fan of the Clark Brothers, and I'm a fan of what they do, and I'm a fan I think they're like hardworking, talented dudes, but I've never really got into that kind of music with Demon Hunter. I was way more into what they were doing with. I wasn't really a big fan of Training for Utopia either, but I think that was closer to what I'm more into.
Jeez, Stephen, do you want Ryan and Don to ever come on the podcast? Or?
Yeah, I just destroyed that from that. Well, I did say they were talented, and I respected them, and I think they're cool.
List of all the bands you're in, because I don't think my phone holds that much.
Oh, I'm only in Dry Bones right now, DryBNZ, but I was in Suffering and the Hideous Thieves was sort of the band that I started because I was sick of the magic of working with other people. So I started this band that was essentially me asking a bunch of people that I liked the way that they played music and that were friends of mine to be a part of, so it was sort of singer-songwriter oriented at first, and then the last record we did called Ashamed, it was pretty much half of it was written by me, and then the other half was the band members, and I just wrote lyrics to. So by that time, it was more like a real band. But before that,
For some reason, because I never saw you live at that, but I saw YouTube footage of it and heard the albums. I was always under the impression that was like a full-on, like 6-7 people on stage type of thing. And that's why I was – it did remind me of Angels of Light a little bit.
Yeah, it was always live. We always had a lot of people. At first, there was
– I think that's probably why.
A lot of people.
But you composed all that then.
Well, I would ask the people to play with me because of the way that they played so I could trust them with my songs. So essentially, I knew that they would add to it. So I would write the basic structure of a song and how it goes and share it with them, and then they would write their parts over it.
Nice.
So in that way, it was like a band. But I was used to 90 Pound Wuss and Raft of Dead Monkeys, which are the other bands that I was in that people might know about.
Oh, they know.
In 90 Pound Wuss and in Raft of Dead Monkeys, we had it was sometimes 90 Pound, we'd actually in both those bands, sometimes somebody would bring a pretty well-finished song, but everybody would work together, and there would be a lot of arguing about what part we think should go where and how much this should be better. And I was sick of that. Like, I wanted my songs that I would bring to not be dissected. I wanted them to be the way that I wanted them to be, which is generally 2 to 4 chords through the whole song and very monotonous and a whole lot of atmosphere happening. And that's just generally what I was into. And Raft made these complicated mathematical Doug Lorig pieces of art that are awesome, and I love them, and Doug's an amazing songwriter and really gifted, but I was sick of him and John and our arguments, so I started Suffering in the Hideous Thieves as another outlet while Raft was still a band. And then before that, you know, it was 90 Pound, and that was very collaborative. The last record, which is my favorite, Shorthand Operation, I still really like that one a lot. Was
my favorite also.
Thanks. Was me and John Spaulding and Marty Martinez. That's how we wrote it. We wrote it as a 3-piece. So I don't think there was some songs that were my songs and some that were John's, but we worked really well together on all of them, so it was pretty collaborative. And then I wrote all the lyrics and stuff. And so when I recorded it, I ended up playing bass on the recording too. So those were different. And Suffering in the Hideous Thieves was started to do something that I wanted. Maybe it was arrogant, but it was, I want this to be my band with the people that I want to play with. And that worked, you know. We had lots of people in that. There was probably 30 or 40 different people in and out of Suffering and the Hideous Thieves over time until the last record, when it was more like a real band. There was people from, there was lots of people. Corey Murchie, who plays bass in Minus the Bear, was in Hideous Thieves for a while, and the guy who played bass for a while, and John Vanderpoel, Vanderslice, John Vanderslice, JV, and a guy who played in his band and some other Barsuk bands and some stuff was in the band. There was a lot of people. Devin, who was the original guitar player, has an amazing band right now. He lives in Portland. It's called Vice Device, but he was in the first incarnation of the Blood Brothers. And he was in the Vogue and a bunch of other stuff. So it was just friends that were around in that band. And a lot of my friends played music and were at Mars Hill. So there was, you know, my friend, Joel Brown, who was in the band most of the time. But the only person who was in the band the entire time other than me was Seth Warren, and he played violin. He's one of the most amazing musicians that I know, and I'm always bummed that he's not really well known. Like, he should be in some big band. Like, the way he plays violin, especially in Hideous Thieves, it blows my mind. He had, like, he'd have all these effects, and he'd use a line 6 pedal to loop the thing over and over again, and he used one of those pink Ibanez analog delay pedals, which was the 90 Pound Wuss signature sound on John's guitar, and I had one and gave it to Spaulding, and then I got another one and gave it to Seth specifically because I wanted him to use that. Like, you have to use this in any band I'm in. We have to have one of these. I don't right now for Dry Bones, but when I do, it will make an appearance on my vocals for sure. But that was sort of the thing. It's an amazing pedal. Seth would use that in a line six and then some other things, and he'd get these loops going of this, you know, crazy-ass violin feedback stuff that sounded like an orchestra.
Cool.
So it was always him, but all the atmosphere, and anytime... Oh, and he used a wah, too. And so anytime that it sounds like Jimmy Page-ish, it's a violin and it's Seth. Anytime like, on Rats in Heaven, there's a few songs where you hear this wah-wah pedal and, like, these weird sounds drawn out that totally sound like Zeppelin or something, and it's just Seth on his fiddle. It's crazy.
That's really cool.
He's so good.
Yeah, I've never asked this of any of our guests before. I think you're going to be the first one. I don't like when people go, "Where did you get the band name?" blah, 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 and I've never asked anybody.
I know what you're
asking. I'm going to bust this cherry right here. Where did you come up with the name Raft of Dead Monkeys?
That's perfect. That's a good question.
I actually think it's one of my favorite band names.
Yeah, ever. Mine too.
Nice. Well, then you'll be really disappointed. But here, so Johnson. Maybe it wasn't Matt, but I'm pretty sure it was Matt. just because he usually has good band names and good ideas.
Okay.
It's from an Adam Sandler skit on Saturday Night Live
where
Adam Sandler's this like crazy who was the other guy? I can't remember the other guy. Adam Sandler's like this pirate, and these two pirates show up at this guy's house to date their teenage daughters, and he's talking to them, and Adam Sandler tells this story about, he says, "Once I sailed away on a raft of dead monkeys.
Oh, my gosh. And started to
stink." And so he goes into this rant, and he just says that, and it's so ridiculous and paints the most absurd picture ever that it's, like, perfect for a band name.
That's
such
a cool idea, though.
That is disappointing. I cannot
stand
Adam.
No way.
I can't stand Adam Sandler.
Oh, I love that old SNL stuff.
That's great. No, that's really cool. That's a cool place to pull it from.
Now, I want to say something. I don't know what type of girls you're used to dating, but I'm an old-fashioned father, and I expect my daughters to be treated with respect. And I expect them home at a certain hour.
Sir, you should know that I always bring my ship into port on time. We'll have your girls tucked into their bunks by 2300 hours. That is a promise.
One time we made a raft out of dead monkeys.
Really? Did it float?
Yes. But we had to turn back. It got too smelly.
Fellas, anyone who can make a raft out of dead monkeys that actually floats can be trusted with my daughters. Now, I'm confident you'll conduct yourselves as gentlemen. Have a good time on your date.
It's funny.
That is so funny.
It's obscure, but it is Adam Sandler. It's not completely original, so that's why it's disappointing. But the funny thing about that band is we actually have sometime, I think it's going to come out this fall or sometime, there's a documentary that this guy's making on that band, and it's been really interesting.
Oh, I did hear about that, and I'm very interested in hearing and seeing that.
Yeah, there's a...
That's cool.
It's the production company's called Interesting Productions, and I think it's .com. It might be .org. They're a nonprofit film production company. They make great movies. Like, one of them, there's this movie called You Are Your Body, You Are Not Your Body, and you can stream it. Their whole thing is that we make films and give them away for free. So they sort of saw all their friends making, doing Kickstarters and all that stuff, and they said, why don't we just be a nonprofit and just like ask people to support us and make what we're going to make and just give it away instead of asking, you know, our rich aunt or whoever or a whole bunch of people to pitch in for us to make stuff. Let's just take it to the logical conclusion. And plus, you know, theater organizations do that all the time for their theater production. So
that's insane.
So that's what they did, and he came up here, interviewed us, then left, and I didn't know what was up with it, and I got back to him, and he said, yeah, we're going to do this. He came up here and stayed with me, so I purposely didn't have a relationship with this guy. Don't know him at all. Now I do, because he came up here and stayed a week to wrap a few last things up, and I got to know him then and what he's doing, and I think it's really cool. His name's Nick Toti. T-O-T-I, and Interesting Films or Interesting Productions, sorry, is the URL. They got some really cool stuff. I was so surprised at the quality and the content when I watched it, because I just thought it was going to be some Yahoo making some stupid film about some band he must have liked, because it doesn't make sense, right? Like, he's making a film about a band that doesn't exist and is never going to exist again, and you can't find their music, so it's
yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think it's meriting a documentary in your eyes? I mean, I'm certainly interested in watching it, but what do you think about that?
We'll see how he pulls it off. The reason why, because we were all reluctant when he approached us, and the reason why I decided that it would be okay was because he said, well, I basically think that Raft of Dead Monkeys is the last good thing in punk rock to ever exist. It was the last truly punk band, because you guys actually had something to say against something that mattered and wasn't just opinion or rhetoric. You actually had experiences of basically like being not Christian enough for Christians and too Christian for non-Christians, and existed in this weird place that he felt was avant-garde art at its finest and punk rock at its finest. And so those two things, like, yes, okay, he understands something that most people don't seem to get about the art that I make and where I resonate from and the time and place and what we did. And I liked that approach, and so I said yes. And that was the approach that definitely I think Matt was able to say, okay, like, at least it's not just Christian rocker's gone bad boy or some stupid crap like that.
Yeah.
So
I hope that's the name of the documentary film.
Yeah. I think it's just called Raft of Dead Monkeys.
You guys had
he's on that website, he's got a trailer for it.
Oh, cool. We'll post that.
Yes, I shall.
If you think we should. You guys did I'm trying to remember this. Okay, so I had the EP, which was that DBM? I don't remember.
Yes, DBM. Dave Bonson Militia. That buzzer was my washing machine or dryer, probably, in the background. Oh, okay. I'm in a room, but it's a couple rooms away.
The whites.
Yeah.
Dirty undies, dude.
My dirty. Yeah. So DBM was the first album, right? The first release? And you guys were, like, super, like, on that record. I remember I got it, and I was just like, holy crap, all these, like, X-Tooth and Nail guys are, like, just singing the most insane shit ever on this album. Like,
yeah, totally.
You know, fight the NBA. I remember just the lyrics on that song.
It's totally dumb.
No, but I'd sit there and just laugh, because you'd find the perfect, you know, three-letter thing to put at the end of every sentence. And when you said NBA, I just remember dying. Like, we're going to fight the NBA. Like, why?
There was no... That whole thing is... We just like the... We're going to fight the CIA was the song title, and we didn't have
it's
lyrics.
So it sounds like you're going somewhere with the politics or something. And the next thing I know, I'm just like, this isn't going anywhere. This is just awesome.
It's just nothing. Yeah, it's
bullshit. What are the parts of the
United States of Kiss My Ass? Like, that's hilarious.
Yeah. United States of Kiss My Ass. You're so delicious to kiss my ass. You're too busy to kiss my ass. You're stupid jerk off to kiss my ass. I want to vibrate. I want to fucking move. Come on, kids. Run your fucking school. You're damn losers to kiss my ass. You're dirty. I remember just being like, wow, like, this is far removed from the stuff I've heard them do. And then you guys did, what is it, Thorolev? Is that how I say that?
Thorolev? Yes, it's Thorolev, which is essentially short for thoroughly leveling every dump we play.
Oh my god, that just got way cooler.
Yep, that's what Thorolev means. Raft was all inside jokes and sarcasm.
That's what I'm starting to realize that now.
That's all it was. It was us making fun of each other, of everything around us, of And it was over-personified hyperbole of the culture around, ridiculous. It's pretty funny. Some of it's really snarky and mean-spirited, too.
But there's enough humor in it, though.
Yeah, if you got it, you got it. And most of the people that were fans of 90 Pound Wuss and Roadside Monument that were from in Christian circles didn't get it. The people that liked our bands that weren't Christians, they got it and thought it was funny. So this is why I also, because the whole thing, it was that. It was avant-garde art. It was, we did performance art often with, we had different aspects of that in the band when we would perform live, and it was so much fun and ridiculous at first. There's some unreleased stuff too that we John was way into this idea of writing this rock opera called Hot Pants College that's a sketch from some 80s film. There, inside of this 80s film, there was some people making a film or doing something else that was titled Hot Pants College. So he essentially blew it out of proportion and wanted to make this ridiculous soundtrack to this thing that didn't even exist, that was all fictional, called Hot Pants College, and God, make it a concept album, like it was high art, but it was just stupid, and all it was about sex and drugs and rock and roll. And so there was that, but then there was some other songs that we wrote at the same time that didn't fit in that I wanted to have on an EP called Joey the Pig Fucker. And
okay, I was gonna say, I was gonna set you up and say, was there any other releases you guys did? But I wasn't gonna say it out loud.
Yeah, so there's those two things that are like kind of elusive, and they exist sort of, but they never got put out. And so eventually they were gonna get put out all together just as Joey, but Matt doesn't like that title and didn't want anything to do with it, and nobody really wanted to put it out, a title of a record, like the people that we knew at the time who were putting out records called Joey the Pig Fucker. So,
imagine that.
Essentially, it never came out.
Yeah.
I looked up Hot Pants College, and it's just a bunch of pictures that I should probably delete from my phone.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. That's great. So, oh man, you guys got a documentary
coming out of this. Hang on, I'm busy. No, I'm kidding. Take a break. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, gotcha.
Gotta run to the bathroom with his phone.
Hey, honey, don't mind me. I'm applying for college.
Hot Pants College. That might be the name of this episode. Sure, so,
totally. Do
it. So, So aside from Dry Bones, because that's like everybody says, like the new stuff's my favorite stuff or my most important stuff. But like, what do you look back on with your music? Like, what are your proudest moments? Do you feel like they? I mean, 90 Pound Wuss. You know, you
I
guys
think you were
fans.
Cutting in and out a little bit, but I think I heard you. What was the music that I liked the best?
Yeah, like what do you look back on in your discography? What are you most proud of with your stuff? You said you liked the last 90 Pound Wuss.
90 Pound, probably.
Yeah, it's fine. I really like 90 Pound Wuss Shorthand Operation. I still like that album a lot. It brings back a lot of fond memories of John, who's deceased, and just I really like the process and doing that all. So that one's one that I really enjoy. I do like Rats in Heaven by Suffering and the Hideous Thieves a lot. I like all the Hideous Thieves stuff for different reasons, but the last album we did, Ashamed, as far as a band goes that I've been in, I think that one's stellar. I like Rats in Heaven for different reasons. Oh yeah, it's kind of all over the map, which was what Hideous Thieves were pretty good at doing. We'd have some song that was more catchy, kind of indie sounding, and then something that was totally obviously goth influenced, and then something really noisy. So Ashame does more of that, and I really like the way that one turned out. I think the other guys in the band aren't as happy with that one. I like that one a lot, and I like Rats in Heaven.
Rats in Heaven is one of the coolest album covers I've ever seen, too, I might add.
Yeah, I like that.
Kind of jealous I didn't think to do something like that.
Petrified rat.
It, honestly, when I see covers like that, I'm always like, man, I want that to be my album cover. That's a, nice. such a cool striking, and I love like photography album covers like that. So,
oh, cool. Yeah, that was fun making. I like that. I do like Real Panic Formed because it's got some fondness in a particular point of my life. But I think most of the songs are really long and drawn out, and it's really pitchy album. But that's fine. I like our split EP that we did with the Hush Hush quite a bit. I like the songs on that. I've been digging around this dirt for too long, but you know I'll always be right by your side. And there's nothing quite like taking up the bones of the past. But I'm gonna make an honest woman out of you, yeah, honey. I've broke my back with all this toil, but you're worth every strain muscle that I got. And you know I'll be praising God for what he's done. And you know I'll be shouting on how it's all my mind. So I guess Hideous Thieves is probably my favorite band that I did stuff in. I'm fine with the rap stuff too. I don't like hate it. There's nothing actually anymore that I'm embarrassed. I used to be embarrassed of that first 90 Pound List record, but now I think it's great too. I really like it for what it was at the time. I think it's fun and it's funny, and there's certain things that I like better. Like I like the more sort of crusty, really fast punk stuff more than I do the poppier punk stuff on it. So
yeah, absolutely.
What do you think took you from being embarrassed about it to proud of it now?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily I'm glad that I did that album. I am proud of it. And I probably use that word too. I think it's that I think a bit of pretension and losing it and not caring so much and not being as pretentious as I once was is probably the biggest aspect in that. I think also giving grace to myself instead of some sort of standards, and then remembering how much fun it was and what I was doing then.
You guys were a lot of fun live during that period too, because I saw you at Cornerstone 96, and I remember you guys playing Shout at the Devil. And all I remember was, and you, I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember the PA system falling on somebody, somebody got hurt with a speaker? Yeah, I was at that show, and I just remember being like, "Holy crap, this freaking tent's gonna fall down!" You know, you guys were nuts.
You didn't feel that way. It was pretty intense. That was a fun live show. I could not do that anymore. We actually, at one point, there was some discussion around us getting back together after John died. There was a discussion around us playing the first album and raising some money for his widow, but we didn't. It ended up being way too complicated and hard to arrange, so it wouldn't have been fun. Mm-hmm. So we didn't do it. But
are you far enough removed from all of that part of it and the people and all that you could maybe go back to any of these bands and
do something again. I guess 90 Pound Wuss would be the one to go back to if you were purposely going back to anything.
Well, that would be the only one that could exist, but I don't think it could exist to create new content. If it exists, it could exist to pay John homage and play some of the songs that he did, and it could exist to play some of the first. So John wasn't in the band the whole time. We had two different Johns guitar. John, the weirdest thing is our second record where Meager Die of Self-Interest was half of the songs were played by John Spaulding and half by John Hammelberger. It was strange just because of the timing for us to create and finish the record and write songs. We couldn't teach Spaulding the old songs really and redo them. We didn't have enough content basically, so we had to write more, and that just ended up being a weird thing, but it wasn't weird to them because Hammelberger was quitting and Spaulding was joining, and that wasn't weird. Like it was fine. We all had agreed on it, and there was reasons why. So nobody was. It was just that's a strange record. Half of it is by one guitarist and half by the other. But the one that seems that I'd have the most fun playing, in my opinion, right now, and scalable would still be that first record, because everybody that played on that is accessible, or everybody that played at least while we were touring, somebody would play bass, I'm sure. So that would still be a possibility, and I could do it. I'm not interested in starting the band again with anybody new in order to create new content.
Mm-hmm.
Playing some of those songs would be fun if it presented itself in a way that made sense. I don't think it ever will. So I'm not opposed. Raft will never happen. There's no reason to try to get somebody to play John's parts. It is what it is. It's done. Suffering in the Hideous Thieves is my band, so I could do that anytime I want, if I wanted to, with all new people, but it feels kind of like what it turned into. It would be disrespectful of me to redo it again. Yeah. And it doesn't... The hard part about that band is it's the way that I write songs. That's the way that I write songs. And those are the people who played them. So in some ways, if I do something else, it's going to probably mostly sound like that, unless it's a band scenario with a bunch of different people contributing. But when I write music on a guitar or a bass or a piano and then play with other people and it's my song that I wrote, it's going to sound like Hideous Thieves. That's just the way it is. If it's collaboration... Yeah, if it's collaboration, it could sound like anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that would dictate some of it, because in some ways it makes sense to me if I do anything musically that's my songs, the way that I write them and ask people to play my songs, then it sounds like it should be Suffering in the Hideous Thieves, but it doesn't even have to be, and so there's no rules. It just seems like that would make sense. Well, on the other hand, it seems disrespectful, like I said, to the people who were in it at the last. Like, they even did a record without me called... And the Hideous Thieves. And
I remember hearing about that, actually.
It was freaking good. Though. So
yeah, I was going to say, I thought that was considered one of the better ones.
In my opinion, it's probably the best. What they did was they took out the guitars completely. They said, we're not going to use guitars. So instead, the people who were playing guitars played accordion, clarinet, saxophone, organ, and so all the guitar parts were sort of had that the energy of Hideous Thieves on the guitar parts, but played on those instruments. So there's this weird sort of quirky, almost Tom Waits kind of feel to it. And then they all sang. So there's like multiple different vocalists, sometimes all gang vocals. So there was different, and so you get these different aspects of everybody in the band, and there's these really weird, quirky elements to it. They have it up on either Bandcamp or SoundCloud, one of those things.
Kevin, I need to get connected with a little more of this stuff, because I lost my hard drive with all the music on it before. I haven't even had these albums, the older ones.
Man, if I used to love listening to records, but my record player broke and I hadn't fixed it in like 2 years, and I had so many albums and they took up so much room that I eventually just got rid of them and sold them for space, because I just didn't use them and somebody else should. So
did you post them on Discogs?
No, I gave them to my friend Seth, who was in Hideous Thieves with me, because that's what he does for a living, is sell records, and I just let him sell them and then take some.
I looked through your collection. I think I saw it online.
He probably posted them on Discogs. Yeah, there was so most of it was crazy 90s spazzy hardcore and post-punk and goth.
Oh,
that's
man.
Most of my record collection.
Yeah.
There was some other stuff in there, like there was Neurosis and there was some punk albums and whatever, but the majority, like I had like almost between this, like between my CD collection and vinyl collection, I had like every Nick Cave album and single ever.
Oh,
and
man. Like, I love Nick Cave. I love The Birthday Party.
Yeah, me too. That's one of my favorites. And all sorts of Swans stuff. I had like everything by Swans. And
Travis hates Swans.
Love Swans.
I love that band.
I never said I hated Swans. I never said I hated Swans.
Come on. All right, fair enough. You never said he hates them.
Yeah, I like that stuff. That's sort of my jam is post-punk. And then I really got into the 90s, like... crazy hardcore stuff, sort of pre-Blood Brothers, all the stuff that influenced that, which I love the Blood Brothers too, but, you know, Angel Hair and Mohinder and the San Diego band. So I guess some of the stuff, you know, like what Frotis was doing was obviously in that camp too in some ways.
Yeah. Hey, are you a fan of the early Today is the Day?
Yeah, I do like that stuff. That stuff's pretty good.
Because the only reason I brought it up is because one of my favorite albums is Supernova, and your album was worked. Tim Mack was a engineer on. If I'm reading the facts correctly here, he worked on Meager Die of Self-Interest, right?
He did, and Today is the Day is definitely one of the reasons why we wanted him to work on Where Meager Die of Self-Interest. That album,
that's
Supernova.
Right.
Jonathan Ford was really into that album, and I liked it too.
Yeah, dude.
But a lot of that stuff that he did with Amphetamine Reptile, Tim Mack, we just wanted this noisy thing going on, mm-hmm. and he successfully made it really noisy.
That one was a nice bridge. You know, it's got the fast of the first album, but it's got a bit of a weird edge to it.
It's super sure. noisy. I wish that we would have.
That's the best one.
I wish we would have produced it more. Now, in hindsight, I would have liked to be produced by, like, I think Steve Kravac really nailed our sound that we would have wanted on shorthand, and if he would have done Where Meager Die, there would have been more clarity to the instrumentation. Like, when the guitars come in on Where Meager Die on almost everything, when John's playing fast, they're so abrasive that you can't even hear anything. Like, there's just, like, it's almost, it's so noisy, and I liked that in some ways. But I like clarity in others. And since we had those, you know, we had fancy studio and like all this stuff and paid money to record that record, it just seems like we should have used something else. If I was doing it on my own and making it in that kind of context, I'd be fine with it being, you know, all noisy and stuff. But that's the one thing that I'm bummed on that record. It was fun to make, though.
Yeah.
So that's one of the albums, I guess, that I'm not so into because I hear the songs and I hear what they could have been.
Yeah.
So
production.
Maybe that'll be what happens with Dry Bones. I hope not. We going to talk about Reformation Day?
I have a lot of respect for the Reformation.
Yeah, me too. I dig a lot of Lutheran theology, a ton of stuff about Calvinism I still like. But you know what I really like lately? I really like the Anabaptists. I'm pretty into them.
Yeah. I'm
Anabaptists?
Yeah, they're Reformation stuff, but they were like the influences for what is now called Christian anarchy, for sure. Yeah. They were also the people that came up with the full immersion baptism. That wasn't a Reformation thing. All the people in the Reformation still did sprinkling, but the Anabaptists did full immersion.
Hmm. Yeah, we're sprinklers.
Yeah, I'm fine either way. I like it. It doesn't matter. Yeah. But
I don't make a big point to argue about it either.
we're sprinklers.
But I mostly like the Anabaptists because they basically practice this thing, this way of doing stuff that called for personal responsibility and a lot of liberty and freedom and less of a hierarchical structure. So they essentially created the modern day, like what's considered in church ecclesiology as congregationalism. So there's a lot more like committee and people working together and not necessarily just a lead pastor and a hierarchy like a pope kind of thing around it, which is mostly like that's the way Acts 29 sort of works. They say it's a plurality of elders, but generally there's like the lead guy who gets all the like plants the flag and says, I'm going to plant a church here and then rallies a team. I don't like that. I'd rather have Christian community come out of the people that you're living life with and express itself that way as equals. I dig that.
Hmm. I'm a really lucky guy because I hear people talk about their church experiences and especially when they talk about the denomination that I come from, or the, you know, they say, well, you're in a Reformed Presbyterian church or whatever. I hear people's experiences, and as they describe them to me, I'm not talking about Mars Hill, that's a completely different thing, but as we talk about denominations and stuff, why I like Lutheran or why I like Anabaptist, my church never mirrors anything that people describe it as. It's just one of those weird things. I'm not saying you specifically, but you remind me of so many people in my past several years that I talk to them, and they say, well, the reason why I would never want to go to a church like yours is because, you know, they don't, you know, I'm more about the missions and the outreach and stuff. And I think to myself, well, so is my church. You know what I mean? Like and so many of those types of examples, you know, like where they're like, you know, I don't like that the Presbyterians do, you know, they believe that, I had a guy at work tell me he believes that he doesn't like the Presbyterians because they all believe that only predestined people go to heaven. And I'm like, where in the world did you get that idea?
So like, they're probably talking about, so you're probably in a PCA church, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's some elements that they're known in more other evangelical circles. Presbyterians are known to be the frozen chosen. Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
So, and that could be...
We have a good sense of humor about it, but... Yeah.
Yeah. And that could be spoken of for anybody who's not high level works-based. So I could be considered one of the frozen chosen for sure. I definitely like the idea of being and thinking of Christ as the ultimate person who was and is. Like he just is. He just bees. And the whole time he was around, he just wandered the earth like Cain from Kung Fu and said things to people and did things with people, and that's what he did. He was on a trajectory to get to Jerusalem eventually, right, and eventually be dead and rise. But
yeah.
That's like he just was present, fully present with the people he was with 100% of the time. There wasn't some other agenda or politics playing in. And so in my sense, he's like, even the way he talked about how he'll take care of us, like with provision, like how does he take care of the plants and the birds?
Mm-hmm.
And even more so will he take care of us. Like, right? Like he did this thing of just being and trusting. And that to me is so different than the world that we live in today that you have to worship money. You're forced to. There's no other way to do it. Money has to be a large priority in your life that it involves a form of worship towards. And I don't think that that's a healthy thing. He even says that you can't worship both, and I think he's right. And his grace is sufficient for all of us, because we as Americans, I don't care, no matter who you are, we worship money. We just do.
Yeah.
It's the way that it is. We worship money because most of our week is spent earning that thing called a dollar so that we can have a roof over. You know what? You can go into the middle of Kentucky somewhere where there's nobody, or Georgia, or any state. There's large areas that aren't populated. Anybody could go, build a shelter, plant some food, raise an animal. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to give in to these things. Like, right. None of us are going to do that. So following, like, I am just thankful that I get to be his kid in the midst of my own crap and working it out, because it's deep. If I was to live the ways of Jesus, I would live in a tent with a bunch of homeless people, and I would proclaim the glory of God over and over and over again all day long. And I would walk around and, I mean, really, like, am I going to live like Jesus? Probably not. But I'm going to do those same things, and the principles are still there. That's why, you know, the fruits of the Spirit, love, grace, joy, peace, kindness, all those things, the greatest of these is love. Like, they're all present. Those are what those are the things that show the narrative. If I was going to every jot and tittle for my arguments, man, I would be a condemned man, because I would read the Bible and suddenly, like, everything that I do is completely wrong and antithetical to the way of Jesus, and I need to stop eating bacon. Like, there's a lot of things that are massive. So in the end, I really do believe that it's about the narrative story and about the overall pictures, and the minor things are minor. Like, even the issues of transgender and homosexuality, I don't need to have an opinion about. God does. God knows. I don't know what it is. Like, I know what it means to be human, and that life is complicated, and that's a very complicated issue, particularly the transgender. I don't know anything about it. Like, everything I read, it's like, oh my gosh, those people, they're like, that must suck to feel like you're trapped and you're something else. Like, I can imagine that, and that's not how God intended it to be. To feel like you're something other than whom he made, that would suck. So what do? You make these complicated decisions, and it is what it is, but it doesn't make you less human, and it doesn't make the grace of God any less for you and your life than mine, whoever experiences those. So the main theme isn't even those things. The main theme is something completely different. Does that give me, like, I'm not interested in being either one of those. I'm a straight white guy, and I'm going to always be that. Like, that's where I'm at. So I don't know, but I can love somebody who has those complicated issues in their life, and I can be empathetic towards, and right and wrong becomes less to me than Jesus Christ loves you, because he really does. So I felt like in some of the ways that we did stuff at Mars Hill, I did definitely become that asshole, because for a while, like, I thought I had it figured out and knew what those things meant, but they're complicated and they're intense, and I don't, like, that stuff is way beyond my pay grade.
Yeah.
And I don't need to engage in anything negative towards those human beings in any way, shape, or form. When there's so much more positive to engage with, which is that God understands, he became one of us, and he knows the complexities of this life that we live, and he understands it, and he doesn't condemn you, and he loves you. Like, to me, that's a great story. Anyway, yeah, I just went off again. Sorry, I keep going.
No, yeah, I like to let people speak for them, for what they're, you know. Obviously, I don't see eye to eye 100% on everything you're saying, but I mean, that's not the point of the podcast, and I don't edit what people think.
Now it's been over 2 hours. You guys want to do an intro?
Yeah. Yeah, we should. We should probably. Get
go. What do I do?
Just sit there and shut up, would you?
Yep.
I was totally Travis kidding. Is such a jerk.
I'm totally kidding.
I don't think people get your humor right off the bat. Sometimes you just sound like a dick.
That's my coming from the guy Raft the Dead Monkeys. I think he's got that sense of humor in there somewhere.
All right, fair enough.
He definitely doesn't know me, so that probably wasn't called for. So Jeff, I'm sorry if I offended you.
It's okay.
Jeez.
I didn't mean to make him Jeff suffering more than he had to.
That's
all I can pull out after 2 hours. I'm going numb. My coccyx hurts.
I'm crying right now.
Sit on it.
So,
you're seriously not going to let me do an intro yet? Okay.
All right. Go ahead, do the intro. This is going to sound so funny after we just talked for 2 hours. But
I know, right? Yeah, he has to cut this.
We're going to welcome you to our show now.
He has to cut this and move it forward 130 minutes.
Oh, you guys will be shocked at how it's going to sound like we had a punch list that went straight from A to B.
Oh, this is going to be good.
It'll take me forever, but we'll get it.
Welcome ahead, back Trav.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Wait 2 friggin' hours to do that.
Go.
Welcome back to the next chapter as the story grows. My name is Trav, and I got Steven on the other side. How you doing, Steven?
I'm doing good.
Are you? What's so funny?
We're recording this intro out of order, but hey, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, but I trust your editing skills. You've proved that you know how to make this sound fantastic.
Yep.
And you're going to do everything you can to make our guest Jeff Betker sound
AKA,
fantastic.
AKA Jeff Suffering. Yeah. For those Tooth and Nail fans that are listening.
Mm-hmm. That's 90-pound Jeff, Raft of Dead Jeffs.
Don't keep doing that.
Yeah? Used to be a pastor, Jeff Hill.
Stop.
Suffering Hill.
This is Church. Terrible. We're doing this over. We're not airing this.
That's good.
Oh, God. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks. Here I am.
What's going on? What do you want to...
The pastor of Jeff Hill.
What do you want to talk about?
Jeff Hill.
I like that.
I'm going to conquer the world in the name of Jesus.
Gentlemen, Raft of Dead Jeff Mars.
Hill.
Yes. Wow. Jeff Wuss, ladies and gentlemen.
Jeff Wuss, that's a good one, actually.
Unfortunately, I'm like way too big now to be a...
Too big to be a wuss?
Too big to be a wuss. Nobody would... I guess I could be cuddly.
I'll take cuddly.
That works.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for sharing your... a lot of your life with us tonight, man. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Good night. I'll see you guys later.
Yep.
Later, buddy.
Bye. Take care.
Another casualty, misplaced, misfit, degenerate, youth not reckoned with. A doctor, just a guy who doesn't make all everyone quiet in a world to gain. You make me ashamed of a human, it's what I can't help born into this world. With me and you, nothing else will do. I make you so much better. At least I know why I'm here, at least I know why I do. I'm still a wild man, I'm still trying. At least I know why I'm here, at least I know what it is. I'm still a wild man, I'm still trying. My flesh is still dusty, but that won't hold on to me. Our faith is great. And make no room for the other who lies and cheats and steals from me with. And the circus, with a man who can be the arm, I can tell the other chicken that you have. And it's when you have a chicken on the other chicken that you think you want. At least I know why I'm here, at least I know what to do. At least I know where I'm here, at least I'm still trying. At least I know why I'm here, at least I know what to do. At least I know where I'm here, at least I'm still dying.
We love you, take care, bye bye.